Well, he's the man, Stanton Friedman, and we'll be back with Stan in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Stanton, you have said all along that we have a primitive society, so why come here if you're an extraterrestrial?
Well, my paper has lots of reasons. One is that we are the densest planet in the solar system. I'm not talking about the people now. But
I was going to say their mental state or what?
No. A cubic foot of Earth weighs more than a cubic foot of any other planet in our solar system. That means more heavy metal here. And heavy metals are peculiar, that is, they're not very common in the universe. We know from studying the spectra from stars. And I'm talking things like gold, uranium, rhenium, osmium, platinum, rhodium, tungsten, much, much heavier than lead, incidentally. And so they may be mining the goodies here. They may be here to mine the asteroids and checking us out at the same time, or... You know, it's kind of funny. We know that at the bottom of the ocean there are nodules of all kinds of good metals. But, you know, our nuclear submarines are used for carrying nuclear-tipped missiles so we can retaliate if somebody attacks us from under the ocean. We're not recovering those minerals. They could be graduate students doing their thesis work on the development of a primitive society. You're a broadcaster. They could be having weekly broadcasts, Idiocy in the Boondocks. And there's a whole long list of these. The one I like the most, really, I mean, in other words, you got to stand back and say, what are people doing at O'Hare Airport? Are they all there for the same reason? Of course not. They're there for sports competitions and to visit Aunt Minnie and to, you know, see a girlfriend and all kinds of business deals, all kinds of stuff. Going to Las Vegas or Hawaii, you know, these are not exactly business trips, but to have fun. And the kicker here is that, you know, you wouldn't think about going to Las Vegas if you had a walk from where I live, for example. I mean, it's a long way to go and it would take a long time, and I don't get that much time for a vacation. But if you can fly there in a few hours, that's different.
It's worth
so
it.
If these guys have more advanced propulsion systems than we do, which seems reasonable considering we've only had technology for 100 years in a neighborhood that's at least 5-6 billion years old, the big reason I think they're here, I mean, all the other stuff is aside. You know, we have motherships coming here that are half a mile long. They probably have, you know, 100 Earth excursion modules on board and each one doing a different task. We're somebody's colony, we're somebody's crop, you know, they're studying languages and they're picking plants and doing genetic studies, all the rest of that. But I make one assumption about every advanced civilization that I think is a reasonable one, and that is it's concerned about its own survival and security.
True.
You know, we on Earth are spending $1 trillion on that sort of stuff. I mean, some of it's nasty, but still. And if that being the case, you have to keep tabs on the primitives in the neighborhood, but only close tabs on those primitives who show signs of being able to bother you. And at the end of World War II, after a century of development which made clear we were moving along, you know, blast furnaces and all kinds of other things, putting out chemicals that clearly indicate this is not just an agrarian society, cavemen or whatever. At the end of World War II, three signs that soon we be moving out, which I think would scare the heck out of any visiting alien. These guys, we don't want them out there. The three signs were nuclear weapons, which pollute the atmosphere in ways that are easy to measure with air sampling.
Which we've really perfected now, I guess, since the days of World War II.
Well, yeah, I would think so. I mean, they tell you a story very quickly. Secondly, V-2 rockets, remember during the war, from Germany to England in a hurry with explosives, not with friendship letters. And three, I'll call it radar as an example, sophisticated electronics. You know, we used to have AM radio. The signal stuck within the atmosphere, obviously fairly primitive. But suddenly, the development of electronics during World War II moved along very, very quickly, radar being perhaps the best example of that. And you put all those together, and uh-oh, these idiots are going to be bugging us. Now, isn't it amazing that the only place on the entire planet in July 1947 where you could study all three of these was southeastern New Mexico? Trinity site, first atomic bomb, was it July 16th, 1945? After the war, we were firing captured German V-2 rockets there, and that's where we had our best radar to track the rockets, which somehow didn't always go where they were supposed to go.
And were those von Braun projects in Germany?
Were they what?
Werner von Braun projects, those rockets from Germany?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Werner von Braun was, and remember, he came to head up the Saturn V program, too.
Yeah.
Because of him. Yeah, he was brought over as part of Operation Paperclip.
Yep, that's true.
And, of course, they violated a few rules. Supposedly, you couldn't bring over any scientist who had been connected with the Nazis. And we said, we don't care about that. We need these guys because if we don't get them, the Russians will get them.
Yep.
And so, incidentally, that gave us a real hold on the guys who came over because if they got sent back, they sure as heck didn't want to go to Russia. Not once they'd been in the United States. You can imagine that, you know, Russia lost 20 million people during World War II. The place was destroyed.
You remember the day, I think you had a debate with Seth Shostak, remember, on our show?
Oh, I remember very well.
And in the poll, you won.
Question,
Stephen Greer has said on my program and with Art on the weekend repeatedly that there are signals that have been picked up by SETI and that he has SETI sources that tell him this is indeed the case. Now, according to Seth, there aren't a lot of SETI sources. There's only three major guys there. And also, he told me once again, we did not pick up any signals. And he said, George, if we do, we want the world to know about it.
Well, certainly would help job security, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So based on some of that and the fact that, we don't have the disclosure of who's saying this, in this particular case, do you think Seth is the one telling the accurate story?
Well, I hate to admit it, but yes. Well, I say that because even though Seth constantly will mention UFOs, it's obvious he doesn't know anything about them. And that was obvious when we were on the program doing the debate.
Right. He believes in life out there, but he just doesn't believe it's here.
Yeah, they're not coming. Look, if they're coming here, who needs SETI? I mean, think about that for a minute.
Good point. They've bypassed
but
it.
I can find no support for Steve's position on this. And he says something else that bothers me. He says we've discovered, figured out, developed free energy that would save the world, you know, all kinds of oil and pollution and all the other things that would come if we had free energy. And I haven't seen any signs of that. I mean, you know, free energy is one of those terms that bothers me. Yeah, the wind is free, but the windmill isn't. The sun is free, but
the solar panels
aren't free.
Yeah, exactly.
And neither the sun doesn't shine all the time, and the wind doesn't blow all the time. So, you know, show me and I'll believe it. And, you know, people have been talking about free energy for, 20, 30 years. And a lot of times you have a guy build a tiny little device and say, see? But scaling up from small to big is fraught with difficulty because some of the problems, I mean, the mass goes up, the weight of the thing goes up as the cube of the dimension. The drag goes up as the square. So, you know, when you build it bigger, it doesn't mean it's better. It may mean that it's worse at doing what you want. So I have had no indication that we have received signals. I mean, you understand that there are all kinds of radio signals out there from all the satellites.
Quasars and everything else, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, the universe is full. Although, you know, interestingly, did we know that before we had radio receivers?
No, we didn't.
So there's an interesting story there that illustrates one of the problems, and I didn't use this in discussion because I hadn't heard the story. But in that book that I mentioned, By Any Means Necessary, they tell how a German general in 1939, before the war started in Europe, not long before, had been informed that the English were building these tall towers over 200 feet high and had cross members. And even though the Germans were talking about using these round dishes for their radar, they figured this must have, it's got to be radar. And they're all aiming across the channel. So he wanted a slow plane to fly along and check them out, but he got the Graf Zeppelin, which is 700 feet long, but moved at about 70 miles an hour. So they meandered a parallel to these in a line parallel to the coast, listening and trying to check to see what kind of radar the British were developing. And you know what? They didn't get any signals. However, the British, it was radar, and they were tracking the Graf all right. The kicker was that the Germans were using a frequency different by a factor of 10 from what the English were using. Now, if you, the Germans, who have a common ancestry with the English and the same technological background and are only a couple hundred miles away and have spies over there checking on things, if they couldn't correctly predict what frequency the English were using for their radar, and they never did catch on to the fact that the English were monitoring all their flights of everything, if they couldn't predict it, how can we say what an alien civilization is using as the latest in communications? I have great difficulty with that notion. When you consider how rapidly technology changes, I mean, look back 100 years, George. Weren't nobody on a radio talk show, I'll tell you that.
Dramatic.
And well, no computers and no microwaves, you know, no nuclear, no DNA, a whole long list of things.
Well, what kind of propulsion system, because you've worked on them, do you think they would be using to get here and to get back home, or maybe to a mothership?
Yeah, I think we have two different problems here. Think of an aircraft carrier. When we were bombing Vietnam, you know, we had carriers staged off the coast, and they would carry about 75 little airplanes that would go out, bomb, come back, refuel, go out again, come back. They'd fly a lot of sorties, as they called it. Well, considering the difference in environment between the space between the stars, which is a lot of nothing, pretty close to nothing anyway, and to be in the vicinity of the Earth in the atmosphere, where you've got air pressure, which leads to heating when you're going fast, mm-hmm. when you've got high gravitational field, all the problems of an atmosphere and weather, I expect, based on the wonderful reports of, we have of huge motherships, space carriers, if that sounds better to some people. You know, think of that case in the Yukon where it was triangulated by a civil engineer, Martin Jasek. It was between 0.6 and 1.2 miles long. That's big. Anyway, so we have two separate problems. I think within the atmosphere, probably something close to magneto-aerodynamics. Now, one of Friedman's many laws is that technological progress comes from doing things differently. Obviously, the notion of carrying along something you throw away to provide propulsion isn't very efficient. You know, when you think about it, that's what airplanes do.
Well, that's true. And cars and everything else.
Yeah, you use the fuel to lift the fuel to lift the fuel, et cetera. That's not too sharp. So if you can ionize the air to make it an electrically conducting fluid and have electric and magnetic fields, then you can control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, radar profile. These are all boundary layers. You know, that's what happens where the object meets the atmosphere that affects everything.
How about wormholes also as a traveling mechanism?
Well, wormholes might be useful for the long distance part. I mean, the thing is that, you know, going the speed of light in the atmosphere doesn't make any sense. It takes a seventh of a second to move around the planet all the way. How do you meet somebody for lunch at that speed, George?
That's true. Well, you don't have to worry about picking up the check either, Stan.
Well, that's true. That's true. So between the stars, on the other hand, is an entirely different proposition because the distances are much greater. You know, it's like I don't get out of my house and onto a 747 in the backyard. I drive to the airport, I take a small plane to a bigger airport, and then I get on a 747. Well, the big motherships, I think, the easiest suggestion to make, even though I think they work by techniques about which we know nothing because we are ignorant, we're not advanced, we haven't been around very long, The obvious thing is one I worked on more than 40 years ago, nuclear fusion. Now, fusion is something we know a lot about. It's what gives us the energy from the sun. That's how all the stars operate. So every advanced civilization is going to know about fusion. We figured out how it worked back in 1937, I think it was.
How come we've never used it?
Well, we do use it. H-bombs use it very nicely.
I mean in practical sense, not
okay.
to destroy.
To produce electricity, you got to be economically competitive. We know how to do that already with coal and oil and nuclear power plants. The first, to make show that the system works, you'd need to build a big one, costing a few billion dollars. Nobody wants to invest that kind of money unless they're sure it'll work for 20 years, 25, 30, whatever. And also, too many physicists and not enough engineers. We like doing physics experiments, and there is a small amount of work going on in nuclear fusion. And, you know, back in 1975, well, give us 15, 20 years, and we'll have the problem solved. Forward 10 years, give us 15 or 20 years, and we'll have the problem solved. What are we saying now? Give us 15 or 20 years, and we'll have the problem solved. We haven't put a lot of resources in it, and we need the engineering more than we need the physics. But nuclear fusion for propulsion in deep space, where nature gives you a nice big vacuum chamber, the systems we were looking at in a big study we did for the government were deuterium, that's heavy hydrogen, and helium-3, sort of light helium. Now, these are the two most abundant isotopes in the world, hydrogen and helium, and the two lightest, which makes it very convenient. But the nice thing is, if you react those two, you get charged particles, and they have the beauty of being able to be guided by electric and magnetic fields, whereas neutrons, which we were looking at for the earthbound systems, go out in all directions, and they're a pain in the butt. You've got to absorb them, they produce heat, and then, you know, you've lost all the advantage. So we looked at nuclear fusion, and it appears that if you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end that only have 10 million times more energy per particle than they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million times. That's something we know about. And incidentally, we have small controlled fusion devices, little accelerators that we put down oil well boreholes to find out how much hydrogen is around, which tells you how much oil and gas and stuff like that is around. You can buy these. I mean, they're not cheap, but and you can't use them in your backyard.
Right.
But, I mean, there are limits on the stuff that you use. But
it'd be nice, though, if every home had its own system where you were self-contained and what the electricity you didn't use, you just sent it on down the grid.
Well, yeah, but that's one of the problems with the free energy, with solar and windmills, is that we don't have a way to store energy. In other words, in the middle of the night, what are you going to do with it? That's the nice thing about nuclear power plants. You base load them, you run them 24/7 and run them for a year. That's been done, incidentally, longer than a year, actually. But and that way you don't need to worry about storage, and you turn on and off the coal fired and the oil fired and the natural gas fired and stuff. So fusion is one technique. Then you get into all these other things, you know, string theory and warping.
Wormholes, yeah.
Yeah, wormholes and white holes and black holes and all this stuff. Now, an important point to make here is that I'm not saying that when a craft lands on our planet that it just came from home. You know, the mothership may be stationed out in the asteroid belt. There may be a base on the backside of the moon.
Sure. You're all possible.
Yeah. When I go anyplace from Fredericton, we have direct service to, Halifax, Montreal, and Toronto, and Boston, four cities. So when I went to that Whole Life Expo, I had to take three planes to get there. My longest lecture tour, when I was a young man, I must say, I did.
Hold the story, Stan. Let's take this quick break, and we'll be right back. And with our special guest tonight, Stanton Friedman, we're going to take your phone calls next hour with Mr. Friedman. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about UFOs and also get into, of course, you know, last week when I interviewed Bill Burns, the co-author of the book The Day After Roswell about Colonel Corso, Philip Corso, the late Philip Corso. We'll get Stan's reaction to him as well on Coast to Coast AM. Stan, did you want to finish the story you were talking about being a young man,
yeah.
I guess, in college?
This business of where you're coming from when you show up at someplace strange. I once did 25 lectures in 35 days in 15 states.
My, that's a lot of traveling.
When I was younger, I saw spring come in three times that year, different parts of the country. I was never home from the time I left the first time until I finished all 25 lectures. I didn't go out, back, out, back, out, back.
And so, you just kept going and going and going.
Yeah, from A to B to C to D and right on down the line. And so we don't know that aliens aren't doing the same kind of thing. And I should make another point here, too, about, you know, why come here and all the rest of that. In any one century, it seems very unlikely that there's more than one civilization in the neighborhood going through this very rapid change from being stuck on your own planet to being able to bother somebody else. In other words, we would be of concern to everybody in the neighborhood. Now, one of the places where Seth Shostak and I disagree, I don't think we're the crown of creation. I think there's life all over the place out there. Then we're like the gorillas in the nature preserve in Africa who haven't the faintest idea what's going on around us. The SETI people seem to feel that the nearest, there may be another civilization 1,000 light years away. And, of course, they're going to send a signal to attract our attention. Now, I have no idea why. What were they going to learn from us? We're not the most advanced guys on the block, clearly.
Unless
in other words, everybody out there is either way behind us or way ahead of us.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that.
You know, it's a difference of approach, but it's funny how they've moved the distance that they expect the first signal to be coming from 50 light years, 100 light years, a few hundred, now it's 1,000. And, you know, they think they're being optimistic when they say there's 50,000 civilizations in the galaxy. Well, considering 200 billion stars, that makes us one of a very select few. That's where they come up with 1,000 light years to the nearest one. Well, I think they're, like Carl Sagan said, billions and billions of guys, because they ignore colonization and migration. And I don't think you can ignore that.
Who has had the most impact on you, Stan, if anybody?
That's an interesting question. I have my heroes, if you will. Jimmy Doolittle was a hero of mine, and Admiral Rickover, and Van Bush. Now, Jimmy Doolittle, a lot of people don't realize he was really Dr. Doolittle. He had one of the first PhDs in aeronautics from MIT way back when. He was one of the world's finest flyers. I mean, everybody's aware of that. And he was gutsy, 30 seconds over Tokyo. But what they may not be aware of is that it was part of his contract with Shell Oil after the war, and he was a vice president, that he could spend up to half his time on government stuff. And he wasn't looking for glory. He had his glory. Ike asked him to do a study on the CIA. Now, nobody's ever seen that study, but there is mention of it being done.
Right.
There was a West German intelligence agent who came to the United States, talked to a lot of people in a lot of places, went back and defected to East Germany. Who did he ask to clean up the mess? Jimmy Doolittle. Also, he had a UFO connection. He was asked, apparently, to talk to the Swedish Defense Forces in 1946 about the ghost rockets that were being seen all over the place that summer in Scandinavia. And I had located him. He was still alive in his 80s. And Bill Moore went to speak to him in California there. And he remembered everything about that trip to Europe except what he did in Sweden. There was a little article in the New York Times about him talking to the Swedish defense officials. But so he's one of my heroes. A strange name for a second one. I mentioned Admiral Rickover because he was gutsy. He's the guy who practically pushed us into having nuclear submarines.
Oh, yeah, and handpicked the crew for every sub.
Yeah, I mean, and he liked to pick people smarter than him, he said. And he also had to fight the battleship boys who were trying to tell Congress, you don't want to build submarines, build us more big battleships.
Put more planes on it.
And, you know, the interesting thing
aircraft carriers, yeah.
Yeah, big targets, I think you could say. But the interesting thing is that the Polaris missile wasn't designed until after we had the nuclear sub. In other words, they didn't have the missile, and let's see if we can find a vehicle for carrying it. But, hey, look what we can do. Hey, you know what? Maybe we could put a missile on that because it can stay under the water. They've actually gone around the world underwater without coming to the surface, which is pretty remarkable. So he fought against the odds. So that's why I liked him. Another hero of mine was, of all people, Jackie Robinson. I grew up in New Jersey, where there were the three New York teams in baseball, and I was a Dodger fan, as it happened. Still am.
Love baseball? You love baseball?
I used to. I don't pay as much attention anymore, but the kids were all real fans, and there weren't so many teams. The same players stayed with the team for years, today.
In my day, like you, I think I remembered the players on every team back in the 60s.
Batting averages and all the rest of it, you know. But Jackie Robinson, because there was a guy who not only had great talent, but who had guts. Despite all the obstacles, he did extremely well. And if a black man in 1947, the year of Roswell as it happens, could do well despite all the troubles, then a Jewish boy in New Jersey might be able to make it too, you know, if you push forward.
I mean, I love it.
It was an example. And, you know, for those who don't recall that this ever happened, when Jackie Robinson was on third base, he drove pitchers crazy because he did occasionally steal home. Now, when was the last time you heard about somebody stealing home?
It's been a long time.
But, you know, so I was very impressed with people who had talent and made a difference, but who had to have courage to go with it. And, you know, maybe that's why I'm not afraid to speak out. Why should I be? You know, what have I got to lose? My job? I'm my own boss.
And speaking of speaking out, Colonel Corso, what do you think of that in his going public through his book to just
tell
people?
You know, I wish I knew the whole story there, and I don't think we'll ever get the whole story. I met Corso a couple of times. Nice old gentleman. I met his son, too. If people go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and Friedman is F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. I had somebody complain he couldn't find it, but he was spelling Friedman wrong.
Friedman.
You won't get it that way.
Yeah.
I have an article about him, a piece about him, and I think he exaggerated his role, and I think there's a tendency to forget that the Air Force Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, with whom I had direct dealings and was a big outfit, unlike the two guys in Corso's outfit, had wreckage in 1947. Now, Corso didn't go to work for General Trudeau and their foreign technology group at the Pentagon until 1960.
Yeah.
I cannot believe that those other guys did nothing. Also, he was not an engineer or a scientist, and he took credit for a couple of things that we know where the work came from. A guy even won a Nobel Prize in 1958 for his work in 1958. So I think he overstated his role, which is probably why Strom Thurmond took away his foreword, you know?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
it was really for another book. Also, from talking to Bill Burns, we once talked about this. I had pointed out that Colonel Corso had signed a sworn statement that he had been a member of the National Security Council. Now, I checked at the Eisenhower Library, and he was never a member, never attended a meeting.
Hmm.
And talking to Bill about that, I mean, I got a letter from it and showed it to the attorney, Peter Gersten, who was going to file a suit on Corso's behalf to get all his files, you know?
Yeah.
And he showed it to Corso and said, should we take that out? And they said, Corso and his son said, no. Well, that's not a good place to start if you're going after the government and you give them wrong information. So that, among many other things, made me feel that he was exaggerating. You know, he called J. Edgar Hoover a good buddy.
Yeah.
But his
yeah.
FBI files say Hoover called him a rat. I don't call rats good buddies, I don't think. And so there were a lot of, he was a liaison with the National Security Council. That's very different. You know, it's like the bat boy for the Dodgers did work for the Dodgers, but he wasn't the same as Jackie Robinson or the manager.
Far from it.
So,
but the kid had a good heart, right?
Yeah, yeah. And what a nice way to put that. So I'm not a big fan. And it, one thing that's missing from the book is references, is specific names, places, all the rest of that stuff.
Well, do you think he was delusional?
I think he came to believe a lot of this stuff. I think he wanted to leave a legacy for his family. And I think he had delusions of grandeur, maybe. I don't mean he made up scenes, you know, with, in the sense that we sometimes mean that word. But I think he overstated his involvement by quite a bit. And I tried, for example, we were on a radio program. I was in one place. He was in another. The host was in a third place. About how did he come up with that date for July 6, 1947, when he was at Fort Riley in Kansas, you know?
Yes.
And supposedly saw the body. Was it notes or, you know, a diary? No, he remembers when he was transferred there. Well, that was March or April. And that date doesn't seem to jibe with anything else, with when we know about when Mac Brazel came to town and all the rest of that. And the security arrangements, when you got really highly classified stuff, nuclear weapons components, new electronics, the drivers who carry that stuff around on trucks, you don't park the truck out in front of the restaurant and go in and eat your dinner. There's always a guard with those components.
Yes.
You know, like Wells Fargo is pretty careful with what they do with a truck full of money. And so it didn't jibe with what military people would tell me would be standard procedures. There was no guard there. And also, this bowling buddy, a sergeant, I guess, took him in to see the body. Now, that's a strong violation of security. Why would Corso have a need to know for that? You know, I worked under security for 14 years. That's something you just don't
do. So you think he had some truth to whatever he said in his book?
Well, I think he may have been briefed on occasion and then sort of dreamed about, well, what if? Now, George Knapp can tell you this. George had me look at something in confidence before Corso's book came out and ask my opinion on it. And I felt the uranium got mentioned in there and so forth.
Yeah.
My feeling was this was done by a guy who didn't have much technical know-how. Now, how do you get sophisticated information into the major industries in the country without good technical know-how?
Yeah, yeah. You can't just plop it on their desk and say, fix
no.
this, make this.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. You know, because I was involved in big programs, you know, nuclear airplanes. We're only spending $100 million a year. I mean, in 1958, though, that was when a dollar
those
was
are
really
big dollars,
a dollar.
Though. Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, he did get a lot of attention to the field, which is probably good. On the other hand, Strom Thurmond's getting, you know, saying you got to take out that forward probably helped sell a few books. Remember about banning a book in Boston?
Yep.
I don't think people don't ban books anymore, do they, George?
Or burn them, I hope not.
No, well, I hope so. So he's harmless. And I understand he didn't make much money out of it, which is unfortunate. The book did sell pretty well, but there were legal restrictions and all the rest of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was well-intentioned. Also, he had said he was head of someplace, White Sands Missile Range or Proving Grounds, and when he'd check, he wasn't the head of the place either. So,
Do you think he was like a Walter Mitty Stanton, you know, who had this going?
Yeah, I remember Walter Mitty. Danny Kaye, one of my favorite actors.
Exactly. Do you think Corso may have that Walter Mitty mentality?
I think he might well have imagined himself what he would have done, could have done. And, you know, maybe it's harmless. I guess he didn't hurt anybody. And that's always an excuse, isn't it? Well, you know, I wasn't trying to hurt anybody. So, and it wasn't as if he reaped in, you know, loads of money. But and people are still talking about the book, and maybe that's good. But, you know, go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and there is a piece on him.
You know, the effort to unravel UFOs, to find UFOs, very difficult. You've always called it the cosmic Watergate. Do you think that's the cover-up?
Well, I think there is a cover-up, and I call it that because it's a nice cliche, if you want. And
I like it.
When I started using it, everybody knew what Watergate meant. And, you know, I'll give you a parallel. Jim Berkland, who's a geologist who has successfully predicted a lot of earthquakes, including the World Series earthquake.
Regular guest on the old show here.
Yeah. And Jim, what he was really dealing with was a seismic Watergate. How's that? Well, for people listening, I've known Jim for over 30 years. He was at my wedding. As a matter of fact, my wife and his wife have known each other for 40 years or more.
See, you are convinced. I don't know. You, we get a lot of new people, Stan, that pop in all the time. A lot of people may not know that, you know, you wrote a book called Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C. It's about the Majestic 12.
Yeah. If you want to see wrong information about Magic Majestic 12, go to the Wikipedia article. I couldn't believe it. Somebody referred me to it.
I just found out people enter stuff on Wikipedia, that it's not some official thing.
Well, I got to see what I can do to change. The piece on me, for example, includes the notion that it appears that he only worked on paper studies. Well, I was running experiments at expensive facilities. We built nuclear airplane engines. We operated jet engines on nuclear power. We're spending $100 million a year. I don't consider that a paper study. We did in-pile experiments, tested things at up to 2,000 degrees, which is quite remarkable, inside a reactor for a long period of time. Nuclear rocket program, I had experiments on the NRX-A6 nuclear rocket reactor propulsion system. That was a small one, only 1,100 megawatts out at near Area 51.
You think something's popping at 51?
Well, I don't know what's happening at 51, and I defend the government's right to have secret test facilities, and of course we know you too,
true,
and
you
got 71 and stealth and all that. And I suspect the Aurora, and we still haven't come clean on the Aurora. We wouldn't get rid of the SR-71 if we didn't have something better, would we?
That's right.
I can't imagine that. So, you know, but, and people say, well, underground bases. And I say, sure, you want to escape the satellites. And you want to, if there's a nuclear weapon dropped, you just as soon be far down, not on the surface. You know, these go without saying. So there are a lot of underground bases all over the place.
Are there a lot of countries getting UFO cases, good ones, on a regular basis?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's an international problem. And, you know, I've spoken in 16 other countries besides the U.S. and Canada, and find great interest in all of these. I was in China. I was in Hong Kong last year.
Did you like it?
Just about a year ago. Oh, I liked it a great deal. And they had a sold-out crowd, standing room only. And I went up to an international Chinese-sponsored UFO conference in Dalian, China. It wasn't as fancy. Hong Kong is a very remarkable place. I was very impressed, and the airport is super.
Stay with us, Dan, because we're coming right around the corner to take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.